So we're reading from Genesis chapter 18, which Phil said is on page 13 of your church Bibles, and we'll be starting at 18 verse 16. Then the men set out from there, and they looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to set them on their way. The Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation?" Going to hold it, I think. Carrying on at 18. "Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and that all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have chosen him, that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him." Then the Lord said, "Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me, and if not, I will know." So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom. But Abraham stood before the Lord. Then Abraham drew near and said, "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all of the earth do what is just?" And the Lord said, "If I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake." Abraham answered and said, "Behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, I, who am but dust and ashes. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy the whole city for lack of 5? And he said, "I will not destroy it if I find 45 there." Again he spoke to him and said, "Suppose 40 are found there." He answered, "For the sake of 40, I will not do it." Then he said, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 are found there." He answered, "I will not do it if I find 30 there." He said, "Behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there." He answered, "For the sake of 20, I will not destroy it." And then he said, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak again but this once. Suppose 10 are found there." He answered, "For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it." And the Lord went his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting by the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and bowed himself with his face to the earth, and said, "My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house, and spend the night, and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way." They said, "No, but we will spend the night in the town square." But he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the two men that came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them." Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me please bring them out to you, and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand back." And they said, This fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." And then they pressed hard against the man Lot, and drew near to break the door down. But the men reached out their hands, and brought Lot into the house with them, and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out, groping for the door. Then the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else in here, sons-in-laws, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city? Bring them out of this place, for we are about to destroy this place, because of the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord. and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy this city." But he seemed to his sons-in-laws to be jesting. As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of this city." But he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, and the Lord being merciful to him, then they brought him out of the city and set him outside. And as they brought them out, they said, "Escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." And Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords, behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have shown me great kindness in saving my life. But I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, the city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Let my escape be there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be..." He said to him, "Behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there." Therefore the name of the city was called Zoar. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and he overthrew those cities, and all the valley, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah, and towards all the land of the valley. And he looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was that, when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, where he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived.
All of us believe in justice. It's one of the fundamental characteristics of humanity that we believe in justice. The crowd, as it cries, "Come on, ref," on a Saturday afternoon, demands justice. As we consider the outcome of the Becky Watts trial, are thankful for justice. And as they hunt down the perpetrators of the Parisian wicked massacre, we long for justice. And in this talk, I want us to be clear that God believes in justice. In fact, our concern for justice fundamentally flows from our creation by God, that God will bring just judgment to the children of Adam. And what it means to be a child of Abraham, one of those who have the faith of Abraham, is to have been rescued from just God's just judgment. That's what we've been looking at over the last 3 weeks now, and with 1 week to go, we've been looking at what it looks like, what it means to be a child of Abraham. We've been, if you like, holding out a plumb line and asking ourselves the question, right from these early chapters of the Bible, what does it mean to belong to the family of Abraham? And already we've seen that Abraham became a member of God's family by grace alone. Out of all the nations of the world, God determined to have one people who belonged to himself by grace alone, through faith alone, as a result of his saving work alone, according to his word of promise alone. That's how Abraham became a child of God, by grace alone. And then last week we saw what it meant to belong to the family of Abraham. It meant one becomes a member of the family of Abraham not through what we call possible human means, not by our own works, but by the supernatural intervention of God. And today I want us to see that we become a member of the family of Abram. We are saved from God's judgment as a result of God's mercy alone. Now, there are four individuals who are going to give us our application. I've mentioned them up there at the top of the handout. Lot's sons, who laughed. He seemed to his sons to be jesting. Lot himself, who lingered. Chapter 19, verse 16, Lot lingered. Lot's wife, who looked back. And then Abraham, who prayed and lived for God. That's going to be our application. But before we come to the application, this famous account of the destruction of Sodom teaches us two big vital points about the character of God. First, that God will certainly judge and destroy the wicked. What a relief! And the point is this, that God sees, that God knows, that God is just, and that God will act. And the point is made by verse 21 of chapter 18, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come against me. And the point is made by chapter 19, verses 1 to 3, the two angels came to Sodom in the evening. Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, bowed himself face to the earth, and said, My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go your way. No, we will spend the night in the town square. But he pressed them strongly. So they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread. God sees, God knows, God is just, God will act. The sin of Sodom, as we see it described here, is described elsewhere in the Bible as pride, as excess, as prosperous ease, as lawlessness, as arrogance, and as the rejection of God. God sees our human pride. God knows our human excess. God is just and will judge our prosperous ease. God will act upon our lawlessness. He knows our arrogance. He sees our rejection of his authority. But the particular wickedness of Sodom is that of sexual immorality, and in particular of homosexual sin. And you can see that from chapter 19, verses 4 to 11, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house, and they called to Lot, Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them. Lot went out to the men in the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, I beg you, my brothers, don't act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who haven't known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they've come under the shelter of my roof. But they said, Stand back. And then they said, This fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. And they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break the door down. So I want us to pause for a moment and consider this particular immorality. And I want us to consider it especially because it is such a major issue in our culture today. In the original, the word translated to know, or in the NIV to have sex with, is the word to know. And some modern commentators have suggested that this demand by Lot's neighbour to know the visitors does not actually have any sexual connotation at all. Lot's neighbours, rather, are furious at Lot for offering hospitality to strangers when Lot himself was a foreigner. And it was the neighbours, the long-term inhabitants of the city, who should have been offering hospitality. That is the line taken by Geoffrey John, who is the Dean of St. Albans Cathedral, in his book Permanent Faithful Stable. Well, Derek Kidner, probably the best still commentator on the book of Genesis in my book, says this, Not one of the ideas put forward stands any scrutiny. Not least because the verb to know is used in the sexual sense in verse 18 of chapter 19. I have two daughters who have not known any man. And twice more in Genesis, the verb to know is used, once of Rebekah, who had known no man, and on another occasion of Tamar, whom Judah did not know again. And in both cases, it's undeniably with sexual connotation. And so I want us to deal for a moment with this sin of same-gender sexual activity. Let me say this. Whilst the Bible does deal specifically with same-gender sexual sin, it does not single it out as uniquely sinful. All sexual immorality is the mark of a deliberate rejection of God. Sexual immorality in the Bible is the sexual stimulation of any individual to whom you are not committed in a permanent, publicly recognized, contractual bond of marriage. Let me say that again. Sexual immorality in the Bible is the sexual stimulation of any individual to whom you are not already committed in a permanent, publicly recognized contractual bond of marriage. And so sexual immorality covers all sexual stimulation, visual, verbal, virtual. Why? Because God has given sex as a good gift from within a marriage between one man and one woman. And this marriage unit is a representation of the relationship between Christ and his church. Two different but complementary parties permanently committed in intimate union to one another. Sexual activity is designed by God to be an image of the intimacy and union between Christ and his church. And therefore, for a person to engage in sexual activity outside of a permanent bond of commitment to one individual is a denial of the purpose of sex itself in God's created order. And so Christians are not anti-gay. They're not homophobic. We just recognize that God's good and perfect place for any sexual activity is within the bond of two equal but different beings, a mirror of Christ and his church, committed to one another publicly and permanently and intimately. And sexual immorality, whether homosexual or heterosexual, is frequently part of a list of any number of sins, including theft, greed, anger, pride, envy, gossip, malice. Let me say, there will inevitably be several in a congregation of this size for whom same-gender sexual temptation is a real issue. And I always say at St. Helens, that I hope St. Helens, and may I say, I hope Euston, is a place where you feel absolutely at home. I hope you can be open with one or two others about the particular sexual temptation that you face, in the knowledge that all of us are sexual sinners, and all of us, whether same gender attracted or heterosexual, face the temptation to sexual sin. And at St. Helens, so are there any number that I know, at least, of seven men and one woman whom I pray for regularly in this area for their personal temptation, and I suspect there are many others who are tempted in this way. The offer of Lot in verse 8 is one of the most gross and grim verses in the whole of the Bible. Lot is caught on the horns of the most ghastly dilemma, for not to protect the divine visitors is an appalling offence, and to offer up his two daughters is an equally appalling offence. And his sin, his offer, is on a par, I think, with the wretched families one sometimes hears of from time to time, who offer up a child for prostitution. You can't think what has brought them to this awful position. Nonetheless, the particular sin of Sodom is homosexual rape. And the point of this passage is a point of revelation as God opens Abraham's eyes to see what he's going to do in judging the wickedness of the world. Well, our Bible teachers are always looking for the key that unlocks the meaning of a passage. And rather wonderfully, in this account, the key is given to us both at the opening of the account and at the closing of the account. And there it is in chapter 18, verse 17, where the Lord says, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I've chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him." And so God deliberately reveals to Abraham this truth of God's character, that he will certainly judge and bring justice to the wicked. Why? Because Abraham is his child and he is going to rescue his people through Abram. And then you can see at the back end of the passage, in chapter 19, verse 27 and 28, we have another clue, key, to understand. Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah and towards all the land of the valley. He looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like the smoke of a furnace. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham. And so Abraham pleads for Lot and pleads for the city and longs for its salvation, understanding that God's judgment will certainly fall on the wicked. And therefore we are left after this chapter in no doubt whatsoever about the character of God. God sees. God knows. God is just. God will act. And God is at work alongside his justice to rescue the family of Abraham. All of us believe in justice. But why was it that Jimmy Savile's grave was desecrated after he was dead, if not that we feel there must be some sort of justice? How come the Westminster paedophile scandal causes such offence and there's such a great kind of witch hunt? Because we believe in justice. Why are we so concerned for the Becky Watts case? Because justice must be done. And God in his justice will not allow human sin to go unpunished. What a relief. Here then, right at the start of the Bible, we're being shown this key point of where the world is headed. That the children of Adam will ultimately face God's just judgment for human wickedness. And the point is made through Noah. The point is made here. The point is made again in the account of Joshua and of Israel. Jesus insists on it. And Sodom is used repeatedly in the Bible, if you like, as a template to remind us of this truth, that God is just. Remember in Luke's Gospel, "Likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building, but on the day when Lot went from Sodom, fire and sulphur rained down from the heavens." To Peter, God is not slow in keeping his promise, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. God will act to judge. Jesus warns of it. Paul preaches of it. He set a day when he will judge the world in justice by the man he's appointed. And Peter again in Acts 10. He commanded us to preach and to testify that he is the one whom God has appointed as judge. And the particular sin of Sodom is that of sexual immorality. The sexual stimulation of any other person to whom I am not committed in permanent, faithful, lifelong union. And Sodom teaches us that God sees and God knows and God is just and God will act. But the second key point, the second big picture point that these chapters teach us before we get to these four individuals and our application is this, that in his mercy God will rescue the righteous. And the point is stressed by the prayer of Abraham. Did you see it there in verse 17 of chapter 18 as God says, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him, for I've chosen him, that he may command his children, his household after him, to keep the way of the Lord, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he's promised." In other words, here is my chosen one. Here is the one whom I've made my promise. I must reveal to him what I'm about to do, so that those who are to be saved in him will be saved. And then Abraham pleads for the city. Notice he's not haggling with God. He's simply speaking to God on the basis of God's promise. He knows God's character, that he's merciful. 20. Will you destroy the city if we can find 20? 10? Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is right? Remember, Abraham was righteous by faith, and Lot, though he is deeply, deeply compromised, is also described in the Bible as a righteous man who trusts God. And so here is a key lesson that we're learning here in this chapter, that yes, God is just, yes, God will judge the wicked, yes, he will bring the children of Adam to justice, but he will bless the nations through Abraham, and he will rescue from his judgment those who have the faith of Abraham. And Abraham is saved by grace through faith, and all others, Lot included, with his extraordinary kind of Jekyll and Hyde experience of hating Sodom but loving Sodom, Lot will be saved also because he's a man of faith. And so this key lesson that we're learning about the children of Abraham, that because of God's mercy, the children of Abraham, children of faith, will be saved from God's judgment. Well, let's pause here before we come to look at Lot's sons who laugh, and Lot who lingered, and Lot's wife who looked back. How is it then that this first book of the Bible deals with the sinful world in which we find ourselves? Notice what God's work is in blessing the nations through Abraham. Again and again, God's response to human sin is judgment. Praise God, it's judgment. What a relief that he's not a crooked politician. He believes in justice. And again, his judgment involves the destruction of the wicked. But God reveals his purpose to Abram so that Lot and his family might be blessed through Abram by being rescued out of this sinful, fallen world and saved for his perfect future. What then does it mean to be a child of Abram? Oh, it means that I'm a rescued person. I've been saved from judgment. I belong to the God of mercy. Now, this truth concerning God's judgment and condemnation of this world order needs to govern our understanding of what it means to be a child of Abram. May I say, this chapter is foundational in the Bible. And it should be foundational for Christian ministry. For over and again, in your Christian life, you will come across people, often very fine Christian men and women, who will seek to find a work for us to be involved in for God, focused within this created order, in order to redeem this world itself. Oh, they'll say, yes, God has got a work, a purpose for salvation, but his saving purposes for us is so that we can be involved in saving and redeeming and transforming this world. But this chapter teaches us that God's purpose in saving Lot is to rescue him out of Sodom, even as he destroys Sodom. Kind of language people use who take this line will be that of redeeming the city or transforming the workplace or kingdom building in our college or a cultural mandate. And often it's those who are closest to us who will be pushing this kind of brand of Christian faith. Interestingly, Chris Wright, who is a great one, who came out of All Souls Church, has written a magisterial book on mission. But he argues that the way God brings blessing to the nations of the sort that he brings to Abraham is through social and medical and environmental engagement so that we save the structures of this world. Precisely not what happens with Abraham. I mean, do you think Abraham, as he stood on the mountain, looking down on Sodom being destroyed, said to himself, oh, I wished I'd done a bit of redeeming that city. No, it's been blistered to smithereens. He says, thank God I prayed for Lot. Thank God he had mercy on Lot as he rescued him out of the city. Now to our application. I hope you can see that these two principles, as set as they are right up front in the book of Genesis and at the heart of the beginning of the Bible, sets a course for Christian ministry that we're about rescuing people from judgment. Now to our application. Lot's sons laughed. Well, we can read about Lot's sons in chapter 19 and verse 12 to 14. Glance at them for a moment. They're so typical. The men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we're about to destroy this place because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, up, get out of the place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city. But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting. From time to time, you will come across people who have persuaded themselves that there's a God in heaven who doesn't believe in justice. It's a bizarre intellectual position to hold. I remember at a carol service at St. Helens, the speaker being very plain about the justice of God. And we'd invited a whole load of our children's school friends, parents, and one of them was a senior legal figure in the City of London. Spent his life dealing in justice. And over dinner he said to me afterwards, they came back to our house, it's well worth doing that, so you can know we were chatting away about the carol. He said, I think it's immoral that you teach all these young people that God is going to judge. And I said to him, I think it's most extraordinary that you, a man of the law, don't believe in justice. How strange. Would you pass the salt? You know, you always say, would you pass the salt at a time like that, don't you? And we moved along happily. I'm not sure he moved along quite so happily, but you know what I mean. It is, of course, the second oldest lie in the book, isn't it? When you think about it, it's the second oldest lie in the book. You will not surely die. The second lie in the Bible. Satan's lie to Eve. No judgment. And so Lot's sons-in-law, who laugh, are typical of so many. Notice the grace of God. I love the grace of God in verses 12 to 14. You know, he wants to rescue these guys. Have you anybody else? Isn't it beautiful? God wants them rescued. Is there anybody else in your college, in your friendship group who can come and hear the gospel? Is there anybody else? And so Lot goes out of his house to the lust-crazed mob and pleads with the husbands of his daughters, come out. But they're children of Sodom. And you can imagine there, can't you? Nice one, Sodom. Oh, good banter, Lot. Nice one, Lot. You think there's going to be a God who's going to come back and judge Lot? Don't be so ridiculous, Lot. How medieval you are, Lot. How dare you moralize us, Lot. Lot's sons-in-law. If anybody here this evening thinks we are joking, or that Jesus is jesting when he warns us of coming judgment, no, Jesus is deadly serious. That's why he went to the cross. Lot. You notice Lot in verses 15 and 16. As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he lingered. And so the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. And so salvation came to Lot, could we say, in spite of Lot? You know, there's so little, isn't there? It'd be great to do a character study of Lot. I mean, there's so little that is desirable in Lot. Back in chapter 14, at the first opportunity, he distanced himself from Abram, the man of faith. He actually chose to live in Sodom because he could see, touch, feel, and own stuff there. And Lot's presence in Sodom was a mark of Lot's worldliness. And even here in chapter 19, do you notice how Lot pleads to remain part of Sodom? Did you notice verse 20? I mean, it is pathetic, isn't it, really, when you hear Lot. Behold, this city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be saved. If you were a film director, wouldn't it be a graphic scene as the volcanic subterranean activity increased and the bitumen pits began to boil over and the ash was raining down, and the camera zooms in on Lot pleading with the men, oh, let me go and have a little bit of Sodom, please. And yet Lot hates Sodom and he knows it's wrong. He's such a contradiction. He's such a Jekyll and Hyde. He makes disastrous choices. He loves the world. He hates the world. He's reluctant to leave. He hates the wickedness. Lot lingered. Did you notice how Lot is actually saved? Did you notice it? Verse 16. They seized him. Verse 29. The Lord remembered Abraham. He was saved purely through mercy. He was rescued through Abram's intercession. You could say Lot was saved in spite of himself. And I have to say, I find Lot hugely challenging. Beware lingering. There is a constant battle, isn't there, between Jekyll and Hyde in our lives. We love the world. We hate the world. We love the trinkets. We hate the trinkets. I need to be dragged out of Sodom. The world is so attractive. Look, here is a town near enough to run to, and it is a small one, isn't it? Let me run to that. The lies of the devil are so persuasive. And knowing myself as I do, and knowing what the Bible tells me about you, I know that you and I need to be grabbed by the scruff of the neck and dragged out of Sodom. Maybe in the area of sexual immorality or substance abuse, maybe in the area of success, recognition, and the applause of men. Maybe in the area of wanting the money and lifestyle and privileges and pleasures that my parents have enjoyed and I want to cling on to. I'm very conscious of the people who in my lifetime have grabbed me by the scruff of the neck. I'm so grateful to them. Mike Neville, currently ministering at St. Simon's Zelotes, when I was a student, aged 18, he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck. Not literally, but he did get in there and grab me by the scruff of the neck. I'm so grateful to him. Mark Ruston, one-time vicar of St. Andrew the Great in Cambridge, before the vicar before the last one, he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck. I'm so thankful to Mark when I was this young 22-year-old undergraduate for grabbing me. And then an unknown person, I haven't got a clue he was, a YWAM missionary who came and took a weekend away for our Christian Union when I needed to be grabbed by the scruff of the neck in that period. And we went for a long walk and wow, there was a battle going on in the heart and soul of William Taylor. Don't know who this individual was, but for 2.5 hours he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and dragged me out of Sodom. And it may well be that there's a number of people here. I mean, if you will be like me, and maybe over coffee in the crush. What do you call it, the crush? I mean, it is the crush, isn't it? Whatever it is, it's wonderful, isn't it? It's a wonderful room back there, but in the crush. You might just say to somebody, if this is what's needed, do you know, I think I need to be grabbed by the scruff of the neck. Can we meet for coffee this week? Wouldn't that be a good thing? Lot. And then Lot's wife. She serves as a real warning, doesn't she, in verse 23 to 26. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of fire. We mustn't be put off by those naive skeptics who pour scorn on the idea of her being turned to a pillar of salt. Have you ever been in a volcano up close? No. Derek Kidner has a brilliant passage on this and speaks of petrification in the face of a volcanic pangenic. And if you can work out what it means, it's a very helpful comment. What was latent, you see, in Lot as he lingered, flowers fully in Lot's wife as she looks back. And remember Jesus in Luke's Gospel. Just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But on the day Lot went out of Sodom, fire and sulfur rained from heaven and destroyed them all. So will it be on the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Remember Lot's wife. Don't look back. They were planning weddings. They were taking out mortgages. They were organizing dinner parties. They were asking potential girlfriends out on their first date. And they'd forgotten that the play will end, the curtain will fall, the clock will strike midnight. There will be a cataclysmic, violent, total disruption and destruction of this world as God rains down fire on the universe and the sun and moon fall from heaven. And so she looked back. If you seek to cling on to the one thing that you know God hates, that you are currently toying with, you will sacrifice your salvation. I say that again. If you seek to cling on to the thing that you know God hates, that you are currently toying with, you will lose your salvation. Don't look back. One former bishop in the Church of England, J.C. Ryle, he who looks back wants to go back. I remember a very, very senior minister in the evangelical circles, a household name, threw the towel in about 15 years ago now, back in the late 90s. And before he threw the towel in and went off actually with a homosexual lover, he, leaving his family and his children and his wife, incidentally, he asked me whether he could come and stay in the flat at the top of our house on the telephone. And I was mentioning it to the predecessor at St. Helens, Dick Lucas. He was round for dinner, and we were just going down our back stairs, and he was behind me, and I said, "Oh, so-and-so, he's asked if he can, he's thinking of finishing his work at the place he's in, he's going to come and stay with us for a few months." And Dick just said, with extraordinary understanding, "Oh, brother, I never thought he would look back." Always made me think, you know, how conscious a man like Dick Lucas must have been of the temptation of looking back. And of others who, like Gollum, have clung to my precious and thrown it all in. And there will be some, no doubt, here who are currently in grave danger of looking back. Sodom appears so attractive. And my business is to warn you, and our business is to grab one another by the scruff of the neck. And then finally, there's Abraham. I love Abraham here. He's a man of prayer, you see. What does Abraham do? What does it mean to be a child of Abraham? Oh, Abraham intercedes. Of course, in the first instance, Abraham is Jesus, the man who lives the godly life, who intercedes for his people. But as a child of faith and a child of Abraham, this should cause me to plead for my friends and relatives. And as we approach a carol service season and the opportunity for the gospel to be proclaimed loud and clear through your university, well, I hope you will join with Abraham and plead with lost. Oh, for 50, Lord, have mercy. For 40, have mercy. 30, 20, 10, Lord, have mercy. You've told me you're raising up a whole family out of all the nations of the world, a family of faith, children of Abraham. Lord, have mercy. You sent your son to die. Have mercy. Please grant that there might be some who are saved from Sodom. Let me lead us in prayer. Shall I hide from Abraham? Father, we thank you that you have not hidden the realities that face every single one of us and the certainty of final judgment. Thank you that you've not only demonstrated your capacity to judge in history here at Sodom and in Babylon and at Jerusalem in the first century, but you've also promised that you will come to judge, and we praise you that you are just. What if you were not? What an awful thing it would be. And we praise you that in your justice you remember mercy, that you are kind and gracious, that you do rescue men and women. And we plead, our Father in heaven, for the men and women of this city, of our colleges and universities, in our families. Have mercy, we pray. For your name's sake. Amen.